This is the Behavioral Observations Podcast with Matt Sicoria, session number 41.
Welcome to the Behavioral Observations Podcast, stimulating talk for today's behavior analysts. Now, here's your host, Matt Sicoria.
Hey everyone, welcome to yet another session of the Behavioral Observations Podcast. We are at session 41, and I am really excited to bring you this awesome conversation with Dr. Russ Harris about acceptance and commitment therapy. But before we get to that, I just wanted to chat a little bit about this awesome experience that I just had. I just got back from Las Vegas, where I attended a two-day workshop called Supercharge Your ABA Programming with Precision Teaching. And it was put on by the folks at Chartlytics. And if you've been listening to the last couple of episodes, you know that Chartlytics is a sponsor of the Behavioral Observations Podcast. And so, as I've been talking to you guys about, I've been really wanting to learn what all the fuss is about precision teaching. So I went out to this workshop. It was done by Dr. Rick Cabina, whom we spoke with in session 39 of the podcast. And it was just mind-blowing. Not only did I spend 2 days learning with Rick, but the entire Chartlytics crew was there. And to a person, all of the Chartlytics employees are extremely passionate about what they do. And the workshop was really interactive. There was a lot of different activities that we did. It wasn't just sitting and listening and things like that. And there were tons of takeaways. You know, there are things that I will start doing differently, on Monday, if you will. I just happen to be recording this on a Sunday. So there's definitely things I'll be doing differently tomorrow as a result of this workshop. So they're going to be doing more events like these. There are upcoming events in Miami and Pittsburgh, and I know they're adding more as well. So to keep up to date with the stuff, I would go to chartlytics.com/events, and that will give you the where and when of their upcoming workshops. I also want to let you know that if you can't attend a workshop, or if you want to maybe have a lower barrier of entry into this precision teaching stuff, what the folks at Chartlytics have done is set up a package for listeners of this podcast. So if you go to chartlytics.com/Matt, that page there has a couple of different things to offer. One is it's a really nice video they put together about implementing precision teaching in an autism clinic. Another thing that's on that website is a kind of a starter pack, if you will. It includes a free one-credit workshop for BACB type 2 CEUs about precision teaching, and there's also a free ebook there. So if you are listening to this stuff, you listen to the session 39 with Rick, and you want to learn more about how this can apply to your daily practice, then check out chartlytics.com/Matt. So anywho, on to today's show. I'm kind of reminded about the Aubrey Daniels episode we did back in the summer. You know, if you have listened to that show, you might recall me saying, you know, when I started the podcast, there was this list of names that I thought, oh my gosh, if only I could get this person on the show, it would be an incredible source of pride, accomplishment, etc., from my perspective. And one of the names on that list was our guest today, Russ Harris. And I always thought I would reach out to him eventually, but I didn't really think it was going to happen this soon. But what happened was, a listener of the podcast emailed me, and he happened to be taking an online course from Russ. And so I want to give a shout out to Simcha Charnas of MataraServices.com. Simcha is a behavior analyst in New Jersey. And so he made the email introduction. And so Simcha, thank you very much. So getting back to Russ Harris. If you're not sure who Russ Harris is, he is the author of the international best-selling self-help book, The Happiness Trap, and he's a world-renowned trainer in acceptance and commitment therapy. So since 2005, Russ has run over 500 workshops and provided ACT training for over 25,000 health professionals, including therapists, coaches, counselors, doctors, and psychologists. He's authored 2 ACT textbooks, including ACT Made Simple, and 4 ACT-based self-help books, including the Reality Slap, which we talk about here a little bit. So I think you're really going to get a lot out of this. I'm going to curtail most of the introduction here because he gets into his backstory quite a bit. We had tons of listener questions, and I really apologize because we couldn't get to as many of them as we would like to have. Our time was limited, but I think you'll enjoy what he has to say, time restrictions notwithstanding. So please enjoy this fun conversation with Russ Harris. Russ Harris, welcome to the Behavioral Observations Podcast. How are you doing today?
Very well. Thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
Well, I think we owe that thanks to one of your students, Simcha, I believe. You know, it's one of those things where when I started this podcast, Russ, I had a list of people that, you know, maybe someday, if the stars align, I could perhaps get this person on the show. And you were one of those people. And I hadn't thought I was, you know, in that league yet. And then I got that email from a listener of the show, is also a student of yours. And they made the email introduction. So hats off to Simcha for making that happen. Thank you for the suggestion. And thank you, Russ, for taking the time to join me today. You know, I know enough about ACT to be dangerous, but it's something I've really come to enjoy learning about. I'm not a clinician per se. I'm just a kind of an everyday BCBA who kind of discovered ACT by accident. But I think it was The Happiness Trap, one of your books, that really helped me understand, you know, and get my, you know, dip my toe into the water, if you will. And I've since, you know, gotten a couple of other books. I think I've probably given away many copies of The Reality Slap, which I think is, you know, a great go-to book for, you know, people who are experiencing distress in many ways and things like that. So long story short, this is just an absolute treat to have you on the show. And boy, I am kind of pinching myself here. So, but before I embarrass myself any further, one of the first questions I ask all participants on this show is how they got into what they're doing. And you have a pretty interesting story about how you got into ACT. I know, you know, you were previously a physician, I think even a part-time comedian and things like that. So could you kind of place, I guess, yourself in context right now as it relates to how you got started in this business and, you know, kind of trace it to where you are right now?
Yeah, sure. Well, I guess I was a physician, but as a GP, family doctor, I just found that I was increasingly less interested in the physical aspects of health and more interested in the psychological aspects of health, and became very interested in a new field that was opening up, psychoneuroimmunology, which was studying the links between the mind and the nervous system and the immune system. What happened was, over the space of a few years, my consultations as a GP started getting longer and longer and longer, and more talking to people about the psychological aspects and their stress and what they were dealing with in their life. And then, you know, this kind of couple of minutes at the end, hurriedly dealing with the physical aspects, and, you know, started to lose interest in the, you know, the writing prescriptions and the prescribing and the diagnosis. I just got very interested in the psychology of health. Which eventually, and yes, and as a sideline, I was dabbling in stand-up comedy. I had a stage routine as Dr. Russ, and you know, I kind of reached a certain level, but petered out. So who knows? In a parallel universe, I might have been a comedian.
Are there any YouTube videos floating around from any shows that we can unearth someday? That would be kind of funny.
No, that was before. That was ancient history. But people that do my online courses do get subjected to some of my corny bad jokes and lots of silly videos. And someone once said to me, he said that what they liked best about my training was the silliness. And that was just such a great compliment, because, you know, I think education is a bit too serious at times. So what happened was that I basically, you know, segued careers, kind of moved into becoming a therapist. You know, it was a gradual thing, not a planned thing. And there was like a whole year there where I just held on to doing one afternoon shift a month as a family doctor, because it's like, if I let go of this, what am I? You know, I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not a psychologist. What does that make me? You know,
sure.
And
especially when you spend so much time becoming a doctor, right? That's got to,
exactly.
takes some guts to let go of, I think.
Well, it was a massive drop in income, but a massive increase in fulfillment and satisfaction. So it really was first-hand experience, you know, that money doesn't buy you happiness. And I just, the first model I trained in was CBT, traditional cognitive behavioral therapy. But I was at the same time very interested in mindfulness and Jon Kabat-Zinn's work on mindfulness. And so for a long, long time, I was trying to combine mindfulness with CBT. I was also very interested in logotherapy, Viktor Frankl's work on meaning and purpose. And I was trying to bring all this stuff together and squish it into my own way of working. And then one day I discovered ACT. And it was like, oh my God, all the work's been done already. Here's a way to kind of bring all these, powerful different approaches together. And so it was when I discovered ACT, which is love at first sight, the clouds parted, the angels were singing. Oh, this is what I want to do, you know. And it was through ACT that I went on to discover behavior analysis. I mean, I'd never heard of behavior analysis until I first started training in ACT. I went to my first ACT conference and they were using all these behavioral terms like, you know, operant and mans and tacks and all this kind of stuff. And I'm like, what the hell is all this stuff? You know, so I had to kind of slowly teach myself behavior analysis to fully understand what ACT was all about, you know.
Very cool. Yeah, well, So most of the listeners to this episode will be coming at this from the opposite direction. So most listeners are either students of behavior analysis or practicing BCBAs. And one of the things I've done a few shows on ACT thus far. I've had DJ Moran and Mark Dixon. Actually, I've had Mark Dixon a couple of times talking about ACT with school-age kiddos and his unique curriculum for kids on the spectrum and things like that. So my audience will have some familiarity with, you know, some of the terms and processes and things like that. But I was wondering if just, it's fun to hear different perspectives on it. So I was wondering if we can do a real quick run through of, you know, the six ACT processes, or if there's a different way in which you prefer to talk about that, you know, what would be your kind of, I guess, Reader's Digest version of you know, psychological flexibility and things like that. Of course, knowing that people spend decades studying this stuff, so we'll put that in context, of course.
Well, when I have a new client, the way I introduce the ACT model to them is I draw a little diagram that I call the choice point. So if you imagine a sheet of paper, and about halfway down the sheet of paper, just draw a little circle and then two divergent arrows going up to the left and right sides of the paper, you know, like a fork in the road. And so the arrows start from that little circle and go up to the top corners. And what I say to people is, like, all day long, we're doing stuff. You know, we're always doing something. We call ourselves human beings, but we should be called human doings. You know, even if you're just sitting there staring at a wall or lying in bed sleeping, you're doing something. And so pretty much everything you do all day long, we can class it into one of two groups. We can call them towards moves, which are things you do that take you towards the sort of life you want to build, acting effectively, behaving like the sort of person you really want to be deep in your heart. So on the right-hand arrow at the top, I write the word towards. These are the towards moves we make. And then the other things that we do all day are what we might call away moves. They're the things that we do that take us away from the sort of life we want to build, acting ineffectively, behaving unlike the sort of person we really want to be deep in our heart. And on the left-hand arrow, I write the word away. And then I kind of come back to the little circle at the bottom, which I call the choice point. And I say, you know, when life is going our way and, the going is easy, it's fairly easy for us to choose towards moves. But all day long, the situations that we're in are changing, our thoughts and feelings are changing, and in really challenging situations when difficult thoughts and feelings show up, our default setting is we kind of get hooked by those thoughts and feelings and pulled into these away moves. And so then at the bottom, underneath the circle, I write down situation, thoughts, and feelings. So then I go on to say, so our aim in this work is to kind of identify what are the difficult situations, the difficult thoughts and feelings. And when I say, when we get hooked by these difficult thoughts and feelings, what I mean by that is they jerk you around, they push you around, they kind of take control of you, they dominate you. And so your default setting then when you're hooked is to do this kind of away stuff. And it happens to all of us. So one of our aims in this work is to develop some unhooking skills. So we're going to learn some unhooking skills, how to unhook from these difficult thoughts and feelings, how to kind of handle them differently, how to take the power out of difficult emotions, how to reduce the impact of difficult thoughts. And we're going to have a look at your values, the sort of person you want to be, what you want to stand for in life, how you want to treat yourself and others, and use those to kind of motivate you to do more of your towards moves, to do more of the stuff that works and is meaningful for you. And the outcome we're looking for is the capacity for you to have a lot more choice over what you do, so that when life is really difficult and these difficult challenges and difficult thoughts and feelings, you've got a choice about how you stand in the face of that and what you do, and help you to kind of make more effective choices that help you to build the life you want to live. And so you can see in that little diagram, what you've got at the bottom there are your antecedents, and then what you've got on your left and right hand arrows are the behaviors that you do. And if you wanted to, you could write at the top the reinforcing consequences that keep those behaviors going. And so it's kind of immediately setting up the ACT approach. It's like we want to identify the antecedents to the problematic behaviors and then bring in these unhooking skills to deal with the thoughts and feelings that are antecedents, and bring in values and committed action to act effectively to either change the situation or leave the situation, depending on what's going to give the best outcome.
So I think most behavior analysts can identify or resonate with values and committed action, right? You know, you can think of values as maybe not necessarily tangible reinforcers, because they're not things you can have and hold, but they're outcomes, perhaps, or I don't think goals are the right word, but and the committed action steps, I think, is perhaps the most concrete and readily identifiable by people with my type of background. But can you give some examples of the unhooking strategies? Would that be akin to, you know, what's referred to as diffusion?
Yeah, so basically, I was trying to avoid kind of ACT jargon.
And
I was also trying to, avoid the massively overused and misunderstood term of mindfulness. But these unhooking skills, we could think about them as mindfulness skills. In the ACT model, there are basically four mindfulness skills. And all of them serve the same purpose. They help you to kind of reduce the impact and influence over thoughts and feelings and refocus your attention to what's most effective in the present moment, basically. And so with clients, I call these kind of unhooking skills, basically, just so that, I'm assuming it's the same in the USA as it is in Australia, that everyone's talking about mindfulness and it means 100 different things. And some people think it means meditation, and some people think it means relaxation, and some people think it means positive thinking. So, you know, I prefer not to use the word. It's confusing.
Well, that's, I think unhooking is probably, especially when you put it in the context of that diagram you just described, is accessible, I think, to many folks. And so I suppose when you start talking about things like diffusion and selfish context, et cetera, you can probably start to lose some folks. And
Well, it's a lot of, the nice thing about that little diagram is it makes it immediately starts to put out, we can't just stop these thoughts and feelings from showing up. You know, life is difficult, and in challenging situations, you're going to have lots of difficult emotions and lots of difficult thoughts. So what we're learning is a new way of responding to those difficult thoughts and feelings. So at its core, really, ACT is about flexible responding. If we kind of take the example of an anxiety disorder, you know, I quite often get clients to that come in and they say, you know, oh, I've got to get rid of my anxiety. I've got an anxiety disorder. And I explain to them, you know, that what creates an anxiety disorder is having very limited ways of responding to anxiety. There's no such thing as an anxiety-free life. But most of us have got very limited ways of responding to anxiety. Either we get completely hooked by our anxious thoughts and feelings and jerked around all over the place, or we get into a battle with them, trying to do whatever we can to try to push them away and get rid of them. And as long as these are your only two ways of responding to anxiety, you're probably always going to meet criteria for an anxiety disorder. If you want to kind of get to a point where that label doesn't stick to you anymore, you're going to need to learn new, more flexible ways of responding to anxiety so that it has less impact and influence over you. I don't say it quite like that. I take a lot longer and we kind of do some exercises and metaphors to kind of get in touch with the costs of trying to avoid anxiety and so forth. But that's the distilled message that I kind of send them. And so our aim here then is to find new, more flexible ways of responding to challenging situations, difficult thoughts and feelings. So you used the term diffusion. Diffusion's an ACT jargon term, which is kind of really more flexible ways of responding to our thoughts. So probably the simplest, easiest diffusion technique is I am having the thought that. So your client says, I am such a loser. And in ACT jargon terms, we'd say they're fused with the thought, I'm a loser. And so from an ACT perspective, we wouldn't get into challenging or disputing the thought or trying to look for evidence to disprove it or any of that stuff. We might do a simple diffusion technique like, well, try saying that thought again, and this time put the words, I am having the thought that, in front of it. And so the client says, well, I'm having the thought that I'm a loser. Okay, now try putting these words in front. I notice I'm having the thought that I'm a loser. Do you notice any difference? And what most clients will report is that the thought starts to lose some of its stickiness or its impact. There's a sense of starting to separate or distance from the thought and so forth. So, I mean, there's hundreds of these different diffusion techniques. That's just an example. But I mean, one of the big things that differentiates ACT from cognitive therapy is that there's no kind of looking at thoughts in terms of true or false or positive or negative. There's no challenging or disputing. It's about learning to see what your thoughts are, their words and pictures that are showing up in the present moment, and responding more flexibly to those words and pictures.
Cool. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about, and I know it's a personal a topic for you, and certainly you're free to answer it or not answer it or whatever, but I know you write in your book, The Reality Slap, the moment you write very vividly about the moment you learned your son had autism, and certainly most of the people who listen to this podcast are practitioners, and some of which are parents, some of which are both. And support kiddos with autism. Would you mind taking a moment and just kind of describe it, what that was like, and perhaps how you used or didn't use some of these skills, and if you can kind of give us an update, because I think the Reality Slap's been out for a few years now. I imagine more interventions has happened and things like that. Yeah. So if you're willing to share how things are going with your son, that would be great.
Well, look, that was an amazing an event. It was kind of he was two when he was diagnosed. I had suspicions from the time he was about 18 months, but the pediatrician, discounted them, and I just assumed I was an overly anxious parent. So eventually I got a second opinion, and he was diagnosed mild to moderate at age two. And we started off with the LOVAS program, and that was good. But at the same time, Steve Hayes, the creator of ACT, ACT is one of his babies, but another one of his babies is relational frame theory. Have you spoken about that on the program, RFT?
Yes, we've introduced the topic in previous podcasts. We haven't gone into it in depth for a variety of reasons, one of them being the complexity of it.
The RFT is a post-Skinnerian theory of language and cognition, and basically the LOVAS program, while very effective, is based on 40-year-old ideas. And often, Steve said, you know, why don't you get, there was a guy in, so I live in Melbourne, which is a kind of big city in Australia. On the far side of Australia is Perth, which is the world's most isolated city. And there's a psychologist called Darren Cairns, who happens to be probably the world's leading expert on using relational frame theory with autism. And Steve put me in contact with him. And I took my son over there, and it was just astonishing. When you combine traditional ABA with RFT, the results are so much faster. So I could see in the space of a couple of hours what he was learning in this kind of ABA combined with RFT program was the equivalent of like 2 days of doing a LOVAS program. It was that fast. And once I started to see the difference, I just packed up. We moved. We went to live in Perth. We had committed to a 4-year LOVAS program. Darren said, well, you can probably do it in 3 years over here. So we went to Perth. But in fact, it only took 1.5 years. So by the time my son was 4.5 years old, he didn't meet criteria for autism anymore. He'd made that much improvement, you know. And if you saw him today, he's 11. He's this sociable, friendly kid, lots of friends, and, you know, kind of doing well at school. You'd never believe in a million years that this kid at age 2 couldn't walk, couldn't talk, didn't know his own name, you know, had less than 10 words. You just wouldn't believe it. It's astonishing. So I learned, RFT is very complex and technical, and I learned about it in the worst possible way through seeing my son go through it. Mm-hmm. But I would love it if people that are doing traditional ABA with autistic kids would start learning about RFT, because they find that it tackles many of the things that things like LOVAS programs struggle with, like developing theory of mind and empathy and perspective taking and so forth. But I'm not an expert on RFT, so I wouldn't want to start talking about that.
Sure, just, sure.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
so, a very happy outcome. So I'm so, you know, I mean, Steve Hayes, I'm so indebted to the guy, you know, for giving me ACT, but also for giving me a normal son, well, as normal a son as you can have with a father like me, I guess.
You know. So. Well, thanks for sharing that deeply personal story, and I'm glad things turned out the way they have. And we'll probably do some more stuff on RFT going forward. So, hey guys, I just wanted to take a quick break here. I hope you're enjoying this conversation with Russ, but I did want to step in here and talk about a new sponsor we have on the show. That sponsor is Operant Coffee. Now, you may be wondering, what the heck is Operant Coffee? Well, it's the brainchild of Beth Garrison, who's a fellow behavior analyst, and she is equally passionate about coffee as she is about applied behavior analysis. So let me read to you some of the materials she sent me on this really cool product. Our mission is to help you serve amazing coffee while promoting environmentally safe and sustainable behavioral business practices. All of our blends are roasted with Fair Trade certified coffee beans and made in partnership with Philly Fair Trade Roasters. Our coffee is made from blends of beans from Central and South America and the Pacific Islands. Our roasters are committed to saving the world with sustainable business practices, and during the production of roasting and blending our coffee, they compost, recycle, and limit waste. They are also committed to supporting fair trade practices to ensure the farmers that produce the coffee continue to work in safe and reinforcing environments. This provides us with a product that is not only of high quality, but also environmentally friendly. As a nod to our behavior analysis roots, we also provide a fun operant fact on every label. So on the pound of coffee that I had to sample, of course, you know, I had to sample it. It has the definition of positive reinforcement, and that is the Burris Breakfast Blend. And again, this coffee is outstanding. Not only am I giving it a thumbs up, but Mrs. Behavioral Observations also wholeheartedly endorsed it. So if you want a 10% off coupon, you can use the discount code BEHAVIORCOFFEE. That's all one word, and it's in caps, so pretend like you're shouting. That's BEHAVIORCOFFEE, and you can find out everything you need to know about Operant Coffee at operantcoffee.com. If you're a coffee nerd, there's also a blog, and Beth writes about all sorts of things that she does to prepare the best cup of coffee. So if you're into that sort of thing, there's stuff there as well for you. So again, it's operantcoffee.com, and to save 10% on a purchase, use the code BEHAVIORCOFFEE. So one last thing before we get back to Russ's conversation is, I can't remember if I mentioned any of the areas that you can get more information from about Russ. So there's two places you can go. One is thehappinesstrap.com, and that is that has information about the book, the course, and there's also a lot of free materials there. And then actmindfully.com.au, and act mindfully is all one word. So I'll have all this stuff in the show notes, so don't worry if you can't write that stuff down right now. So I think that's pretty much it. Let's get back to our conversation with Russ. So one of the things I want to move on to is the topic of kind of practitioner well-being and stress and things like that. And I really didn't even have to prepare many of my own questions because I have such awesome listeners, Russ. They, when I told them I was interviewing you, and when I was told them that what the topic was, I was inundated with questions. So I have kind of an easy job of just merely reading. So, but allow me just a second to put the question in context, or at least the topic.
Before we do that,
sure.
Before we do, do you want me to just kind of briefly, for those people that do know ACT jargon, link the other unhooking skills up to the ACT terms they know? Or just leave
yeah,
it?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So diffusion is kind of the unhooking from thought skill, you know, and there's hundreds of diffusion techniques, but they all involve just kind of learning to see your thoughts as just thoughts, and how to kind of, which reduces their impact and influence over your behavior. Then there's what ACT calls acceptance skills, which is usually a way of dealing with painful emotions and painful feelings. And really, acceptance skills are really just a form of exposure, interoceptive exposure, if you like. You kind of bring mindful awareness to the difficult feelings in your body and observe them and open up and make room for them and respond to yourself compassionately while you're having these feelings. And that reduces its impact and influence over your behavior. Then there's what ACT calls contacting the present moment. These are more traditional mindfulness skills, but they're about focusing your attention, task-focused attention, paying attention to where you are and what you're doing, tracking the consequences of your actions and seeing if what you're doing is taking you towards the life you want, your towards moves, or whether it's an away move, taking you away from the life you want. You know, and focusing your attention fully on what you're doing. If you're doing something pleasurable or enjoyable, then really kind of engaging in it and savoring the experience and so forth. And then the most complex of the unhooking skills is what ACT calls self as context, which is probably best described as flexible perspective taking skills, you know, which is so important for theory of mind and empathy and being able to picture yourself in the future or get a sense of and probably the weirdest part of ACT that is in some but not all ACT protocols is using this flexible perspective taking to kind of get a sense of a transcendent sense of self. There's a body here and there's thoughts and there's feelings here and there's this part of me that can take a perspective on all of that and notice how my body and my thoughts and my feelings change all the time. But this very perspective from which I'm noticing is kind of unchanging and always there.
I think that's the toughest one for, I think, people from my background. That's the toughest time wrapping our minds around that one.
Clients too, you know, and so, you know, in practice, I don't make a big deal of it. What I would kind of just say to you listeners want to kind of get a sense of this, then just notice what you can hear right now. Notice what you can see. Look around you. Notice what you can smell, notice what you can taste, Notice where your feet are, what they're touching. Notice what you're thinking. Notice what you're feeling. So there's a part of you that's noticing everything. Part of you that's noticing everything that you see, hear, touch, taste, smell, think, feel, or do in any moment. And we don't have a good word for that part of you in everyday language. You know, some people call it awareness. Some people call it consciousness. The term most commonly used with clients is the observing self or pure awareness. It's kind of like the awareness of your own awareness or noticing your own noticing or consciousness of your own consciousness, if you like.
Mm-hmm. Alrighty.
It's a bit of a head spinner.
Yeah. But it's fun stuff to kind of wrestle with. So, all right. Anything else we need to know before diving into?
Oh yeah. Well, so values then. So values are really basically, I describe them to clients as your heart's deepest desires for how you want to behave as a human being. You know, how you want to treat yourself, how you want to treat others, how you want to treat the world around you. And then values are like the compass that guide your actions. So the final act process is committed action, you know, taking action guided by your values. And that can include problem solving, skills training, action planning, goal setting, you know, actually just getting out there and doing the stuff that's important. And I would say that ACT is at its core an exposure-based model. There's a massive amount of exposure in this model where we get our clients in touch with all sorts of repertoire-narrowing stimuli, which may be thoughts, feelings, emotions, memories, or situations, events, external stuff, and help them respond more flexibly to those repertoire-narrowing stimuli. So the ACT definition of exposure would be organized contact with repertoire narrowing stimuli for the purpose of cognitive flexibility, emotional flexibility, and behavioral flexibility. And that's basically what it's about.
Very cool. So before we get into the idea or the listener questions on burnout and stress management and conversely well-being, because the other side of that coin is we did a really unscientific study here in my home state of New Hampshire, and for the New Hampshire ABA conference 2 years ago, and it was part of a panel in preparation for a panel discussion on practitioner stress, and what we did is ask various questions about the extent to which practitioners in our state are, you know, experience depression, anxiety. To what extent do those experiences interfere with their ability to do their job, their personal relationships, et cetera? And we didn't go into too much detail defining the scope or the severity of these experiences of anxiety and depression. So we don't know whether it's just kind of, you know, diagnosable or just, you know, kind of momentary, you know, feelings and things like that. But what we found is that, you know, I think it was something like 40 to 50% of people identified with, you know, having either anxiety or depression interfere in some way, shape, or form in their lives. And so it was a little bit of an eye opener. And I think in our field, we have a lot of stressors that are unique. You know, I think when we're a growing field, and so the nature of our occupation is under constant change, or evolution, or whatever you want to call it. You know, we work with kiddos who are in these very delicate stages of their lives. We have parents who entrust their children and loved ones with us, and we have this responsibility to make them better. You know, whether that is increasing, you know, communication repertoires are decreasing problematic behaviors and things like that. And then sometimes in the context of our work, we see, you know, things that are troubling. You know, my first job out of graduate school was working in a group home with, you know, severely developmentally disabled individuals. And there was lots of aggressive behavior and things like that, you know, people getting injured and things along those lines. Worked with many kids with severe self-injury. And things like that. So we have all these kind of, we're carrying around a lot of stuff, I guess. And I don't know if our job is, you know, any different from a stress level wise or, you know, as other walks of life, but it seems like we do have quite a bit of experiences that would create conditions under which we would you know, do experience, you know, at least some level of stress, whether it's, you know, gets to the level of significant anxiety or depression or whatever is hard to say. But long story short, there's some uniqueness about what we do. And so it always kind of got me interested in this topic in general. So I guess one of the things I'd like to start with is, you know, how and this is from a listener and a good friend of mine, Shelly Harris, no relation, but she does own the Reality Slap.
she might be a relation somewhere.
Who knows? That's right. It's a, look at me making assumptions, right? You know, so how can we, you know, her question is basically, you know, how can we identify precursors to stress? In other words, how do we, you know, do you have a sense of how to detect when we are kind of about to succumb to, you know, maybe some of those away moves that you were describing earlier as a result of some of the experiences we have on the job?
Yeah. Well, for sure, you know, so like one of the things that attracted me to ACT was the very first training I did. So much of the training was working with my own stuff. You know, we say in ACT, the best person to learn and practice ACT on is yourself. So ACT training involves starting to recognize your own thoughts, your own feelings, have a look at your own life, notice your towards moves, notice your away moves, and practice these unhooking skills on yourself. And so if you start becoming reflective of your life and you start noticing you're doing a lot more to away moves, whether that's drugs or alcohol or social withdrawal, that's kind of a red flag to you. But also throughout the day, you know, starting to check in, notice your thoughts, notice your feelings, notice what you're doing. In many ACT case formulation sheets, there's a whole section for the therapist to write in, you know, what are my difficult thoughts and feelings? What are my barriers to working effectively with this client? Because we need to have a look at ourselves. And of course, we do challenging work. And most of us are quite perfectionistic and we kind of get a bit frustrated if we can't kind of get the results that we want. And all of us have evolved with minds that are very quick to judge and criticize. So the vast majority of us have a pretty harsh inner critic that can beat us up at times. So it's kind of really about developing self-awareness, and arguably the best way to develop self-awareness is through regular mindfulness practice, which doesn't have to be a meditation thing you do in the morning. It can just be checking in mindfully with yourself before and after a session and when you go home from work and in the evenings, and noticing your own behavior and you know, red flagging it if you see yourself doing a lot more of those away moves. Also, you know, before and after a session, if you can take 1 or 2 minutes just to ground and center yourself and just notice what your mind's saying, notice what your body's doing, see if you can run through a little bit of acceptance of your feelings, a little bit of diffusion from unhelpful thoughts, a little bit of self-compassion can make a huge difference.
Cool. Mandy Herlock writes, she has quite a lengthy question. I'm going to try to summarize it here. But she is kind of from two different worlds. She's a marriage and family therapist intern and a BCBA. So she sees these two different kind of cultures, if you will. And then the MFT world is a lot of kind of what you were saying, you know, in terms of focus on self-care, et cetera. And then in the BCBA camp, it's, you know, go, 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 suck it up. You know, be a workaholic, et cetera. And yeah. Mandy, I'm sorry, I'm doing a ghastly job of summarizing or paraphrasing your question, but you know, I'm just, yeah. You get the idea. Can you speak to, you know, I guess some of those more cultural differences and things that we as a field that's basically in its infancy can do to put more focus on self care in general?
I think it is so important, you know, something to you know, a noble undertaking to bring more of that into it. And I think it would, you know, trainers to start including it as part of their training, people going to conferences start requesting it on conference programs, students start asking the teachers about it, you know, get a movement happening. it's certainly, the risk of burnout is so high in health professionals. But even if we move outside of the health profession, the general public is struggling, full stop, whatever you do. There's some of the statistics, one in two people will become actively suicidal at some point in their life. For a period of 2 weeks or more, and one in 10 of them will actually attempt it. Luckily, most people are very bad at killing themselves. You probably know all the statistics on depression and anxiety disorders. Sure. And so forth. Virtually one third of people will meet criteria for a DSM disorder at some point, and one in four people will have a severe addiction at some point in their life. And then there's all the stuff that isn't disorders, but it's just the difficulty, raising young children, or relationship issues, or existential angst. So, the starting point in an app perspective is life is difficult and comes with lots and lots of painful thoughts and feelings. And most of us grow up not knowing how to handle these things. As I mentioned, we've got these two ways of responding to these difficult thoughts and feelings. We either get hooked by them, dominated, and they push us around, or we go into what App calls experiential avoidance, desperately trying to push them away, fight them off, and get rid of them. And one of the most useful things we can do in self-care is learn more flexible ways of responding to the inevitable, difficult thoughts and feelings that life is going to generate for us. In my workshops, I like to ask people, the things that make life rich, full, and meaningful come with lots of pain, right? Whether that's your career, whether that's having kids. And I ask people, hands up, how many people in this room have children? And about 80% of the hands go up. And so I kind of point out, well, having kids fills your life with meaning and purpose, gives you some of the most wonderful feelings you'll ever know, feelings of love and joy you didn't know were possible. And what other feelings? And of course, people start calling out, anxiety, guilt, shame, frustration, tiredness, rage. I didn't know what rage was until I became a father, And then I ask, does anybody here have a meaningful relationship, someone you spend a lot of time with that only gives rise to pleasant thoughts and feelings? And of course, not a hand goes up. Even dogs, dogs are a lot easier to live with than humans. Even dogs will push your buttons. So, of course, we're going to, in any meaningful career, but especially in a career where we're in touch with so much human pain and suffering and difficulty on a day-to-day basis, we're going to have lots of difficult thoughts and feelings. And we want to make it a priority to start learning how to apply these skills to ourselves and look after ourselves. And, I applaud the question. The answer is get active from all angles.
Okay. One of the other questions here from Shiri Bartman is great, because a lot of us as BCBAs don't work in isolation. We work with a team of people. Oftentimes we supervise therapists working directly with children or other learners. Or we are in charge of other team members and things like that, and so we have this responsibility for not just our own well-being, but it's important to pay attention to the well-being of an organization. And I've got a couple of organizational questions here, and Shiri's is this: I want to know more about how to incorporate ACT into my regular interactions with my staff in order to increase their feelings of well-being, basically how to, create a culture to increase, productivity and things along those lines. So what are your thoughts on that?
That's a big question. I think I'd start by putting it out to your staff, saying, look, this is what I'm passionate about. I'd really love to do this. What are your thoughts? And see if you can get some buy-in from it. From there, it would be about, looking at some of the app protocols that are available, and modifying them to a workplace setting. As you mentioned, my textbook app made simple. There's lots of, while that's a clinical textbook, there's lots of simple things that you can take from that and apply in a staff setting or a workplace setting. The nice thing with the app model is it's transferable to any kind of situation at all. It was developed as a clinical model, but it's really a model for the human condition, and it really kind of can apply to any situation. Great thing to do in workplaces.
Yeah, what's funny is I mentioned earlier I had DJ Moran on, and one of his books was written for a population of behavioral safety practitioners. And I got the book and I was reading it, and I was translating, oil rig worker to ABA therapist, and this situation, the parts seem readily interchangeable, so that I could totally see how the safety commitment model that he described could be used from an organizational perspective in an ABA setting. So I could so it's a good point about the kind of transfer ability or
Obviously, you want to modify your language. So,
sure.
That's about talking about unhooking skills rather than mindfulness skills. I've done quite a lot of work with police officers and ambulance officers, and the guys that do that job are quite blokey blokes. They're kind of, if I was to start using the word self-compassion in that kind of setting, then you'd be like, what are you on about, mate? That's a bit girly, isn't it? What's all this crap? So I don't talk about it that way. What I say is, you imagine you're going through a really rough patch. There's all sorts of difficulties in your life. It's really stressful. Now, what kind of mate do you want at your side? Do you want the mate that says, suck it up, stop your whinging, don't want to hear your belly aching, you big wuss, keep it to yourself, button it up? Or do you want the mate by your side who says, this is really rough, I've got your back, I'm with you every step of the way, mate? And of course, everyone chooses the latter. Now, that's self-compassion, but I'm not using the term self-compassion. And DJ's a master in that book. I've read that book. He goes through the whole act stuff without using any kind of mindfulness or acty speak or flowery jargon. You've got to change your words to so that they fit the client.
Sure. I have so many questions that I don't have time to get to, and a lot of them revolve around getting more training. One of them from Carolina asked about your 8-week online program. That is not a planned plug, but she asked about it, so I figured I'd mention it. But a lot of people are really digging ACT, and I think those of us who are established as BCBAs are kind of wondering, gosh, where do we... And I also got a lot of questions about practicing within our scope of expertise, because so many of us aren't therapists. We don't have training to do therapy per se, and I don't think any of us are looking to hang out a shingle and become mental health clinicians per se. But at the same time, we see these powerful interventions. We probably can see a lot of utility in the populations we work with and things like that. Can you talk about the training aspect and kind of, staying in your lane, if you will, of practice and things along those lines? Because I think there's a lot of gray area.
Yeah. Well, so I assume she's referring, I have a website called imlearningact.com, and I offer a range of online training courses. These are the ones that I talked about at the start, which have got lots of silly, funny videos and animations. It's not just someone staring into a webcam. There is an 8-week ACT for Beginners course there, which really makes ACT accessible to, I'd like to believe it makes ACT accessible to really anyone from any background. So for sure, the majority of people that do that course are psychologists, but at times I get school teachers and occupational therapists and physiotherapists and members of the public that are just interested in it, and it's kind of pitched at a level where it really is pretty much accessible to anyone. So that would probably be a good starting point. And then you don't have to kind of say that you're a therapist. You can start. I know lots of physio, I think you call them physical therapists.
That's
we
right.
call them physiotherapists, you know, that are kind of using these ACT techniques with their clients in rehabilitation settings. They're obviously finding the exercises painful, their mind's saying, oh, I can't do this, it's too hard. They've got painful sensations. And then the physios can start using these unhooking skills to unhook from those thoughts, or to open up and make room for those painful feelings. And the clients or patients are then able to do the stretches and the exercises. Now, they're not calling themselves therapists. They're still physiotherapists or physical therapists. They're not counselors and so forth. But they're able to bring these little ACT techniques into their work to add another element that was previously missing. Also, I found this with, I don't know what you call them. We call them nutritionists or dietitians.
Yep, either one.
Yeah, yeah.
There's probably a technical distinction between the two that I'm probably offending many. please don't write in. I don't know what I'm, but.
My apologies to anyone who's offended by that. But, you know, certainly in Australia, the vast majority of dietitians get no training in psychological motivation. So they're presenting these diet plans to clients with diabetes or obesity or heart disease. And it's like, you know, if you've ever tried following a diet, you know how hard that is. So if you've got some little ACT skills that you can bring into that, to unhook from, oh, this is all too hard, I can't do it, to open up and make room for the anxiety, to mindfully surf the urges and cravings that arise for the unhealthy foods and so forth, then you're going to be able to be much better. So they're not calling themselves therapists. They're still dietitians, but they're bringing this stuff into their work. And I think it would be the same for the folks you're talking about.
Great advice. I know we're coming close on the end of your time availability here. So I'd like to close with, I know you've already dispensed lots of great information and advice. Do you have any just general advice for a, you know, kind of a newly minted BCBA? We have a lot of students who listen to this program. People are going through their coursework and they either are, you know, studying for the really hard for the test, or maybe just passed it, or, and things like mm-hmm. that. And so there's a lot of folks out there on their first job, and you know, just getting their feet wet as a practitioner. Do you have any kind of closing advice for someone in that part of their stage of their career?
I remember thinking that there would come a day where I would have no self-doubt, no fear of failure, where I would know exactly what I was doing. And that day hasn't come, you know, and I now don't think it ever will come. I mean, no matter how much training I do, no matter how many books I write, no matter how many clients I work with, I can't imagine the days is ever going to come where I don't have self-doubt, fear of failure. The I'm a lousy therapist story has been showing up for me for 25 years. I expect it will still be showing up for me in another 25 years. What I'm able to do now as a result of ACT is recognize when I've gotten hooked by the I'm a lousy therapist story and kind of unhook from it. There is actually interesting research showing that therapists that are high in self-doubt are better than therapists that are high in self-confidence, provided they are also high in self-compassion. So if they're high in self-doubt and they beat themselves up and give them a hard time, they're ineffective. But if they're high in self-doubt and they're compassionate to themselves, that self-doubt actually keeps them aware and training and learning and open and stops them from the problems that you fall into if you get hooked by high self-confidence and you can lack self-awareness and stop growing and kind of get a bit full of yourself. So there's a quote I love from Sir Winston Churchill. He said, success is the ability to go from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. And that would be my advice. You will fail. You will screw it up. You will make mistakes over and over again. How many times did you have to fall over before you learned to walk? And all the things that you take for granted today, reading and writing and using a knife and fork and doing up your belt. And, you know, that those were skills that took so much practice. You made so many mistakes. You had to screw it up so many times. And, you know, doing behavior analysis or whatever model you're doing is the same. You will screw it up. You will make mistakes. So learn how to be self-compassionate. Learn how to unhook yourself from, I can't do it, I'm lousy. Learn how to be kind from yourself and really invest a little bit of time in learning some mindfulness and self-compassion skills for self-care. That would be my advice.
Great, great. And so you mentioned the website imlearningact.com. Are there other web resources of yours or others and just in general that people can check out if they want more information on this stuff?
If you're looking for something not to learn ACT, but just to do ACT for yourself, you know, for just personal growth or to deal with your own anxiety or depression or whatever you're struggling with, so not professional skills training, but ACT for personal growth, then my other website is thehappinesstrap.com. And there's an 8-week kind of personal growth course applying ACT to yourself. That doesn't counts as professional training, and you can't ask questions on that about how you use this with clients. It's for you to deal with your own stuff. And then, of course, there's the official ACT website, which is contextualscience.org. And on that website, you'll find trainings all around the world and books and therapists and so forth. That's the official website for the ACT organization, contextualscience.org.
Fantastic. Well, Russ, this again has just been a treat. You've been someone I've been wanting to chat with for quite some time now, and I really appreciate you coming on the show and sharing this great stuff. So, thanks so much.
Lovely. Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was pleasure. Fun.
Okay, folks. I hope you enjoyed that interview as much as I did. And remember, we'll have all the links to all the stuff that we talked about in session 41 on the behavioralobservations.com website. So, as I said, we did not get a chance to get to all the questions, and Russ has generously offered to come back, so maybe we can do a Q&A episode and have him back to talk more about ACT and its various applications. So one of the things that would help with that, I think, would be to go to behavioralobservations.com and put extra questions or comments or ideas about this topic in the comments section of that post. So big thanks to chartlytics.com and operandcoffee.com for sponsoring the show. And until the next time, I will see you. I guess it would be session, we're up to 42 next time. So see you in session 42. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Behavioral Observations Podcast with Matt Sikoria. You can find Matt's notes on this episode at www.behavioralobservations.com. We also invite you to stay connected with us on Facebook at facebook.com/behavioralobservations and on Twitter @behaviorpodcast.